They are coming. And there's nothing you can do to stop them. And when they arrive, you'll be so grateful.
A Chinese-born scientist reveals the approach of an alien armada in that scene from Three Body Problem, the Netflix adaptation of Cixin Liu's award-winning series of science fiction novels. Most scientists will tell you that the aliens aren't coming yet. But some scientists have long been searching for evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, a quest that's known as SETI. One of the leading supporters of the search is a nonprofit program known as the Breakthrough Initiatives, which is headed up by Pete Warden, a former Air Force general and NASA Center director. How is the search for alien civilizations going? And if we do make contact with aliens, could that bring our salvation or our destruction? Greetings, Earthlings. I'm Alan Boyle, one of your hosts for the Fiction Science Podcast. Stay tuned to hear Pete Warden's perspective on the issues raised by the three-body problem and the real-life search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
So if aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America. Which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans.
Stephen Hawking thought we should keep quiet about our presence in the universe, as you can hear in that clip from a Discovery Channel documentary called Into the Universe with Stephen Hawking. The potential consequences of making ourselves known play a big part in the plot of the three-body problem. The concept is called the Dark Forest Theory. Here's how it goes. If there are other civilizations in our galaxy, they'd be like groups of strangers walking through a dark forest. If you hear strangers tromping through the forest, you don't know if they're hostile or if they have weapons, so you might think that the two best courses of action would be to keep quiet or use your own weapons first. That line of thinking is a possible explanation for what's known as Fermi's paradox. If there are other advanced civilizations on distant planets, why haven't we heard from them yet? The dark forest theory may be the explanation. These are the sorts of things that Pete Warden and his colleagues think about at the Breakthrough Initiatives. The Breakthrough Initiatives went into operation nearly a decade ago with an initial commitment of $100 million from Russian-born billionaire Yuri Milner, and with the support of leading scientists, including Stephen Hawking. The Breakthrough Initiatives support public-private collaborations to look for evidence of extraterrestrial technologies, or technosignatures, as well as to seek out signs of less advanced extraterrestrial life in our own solar system, and to look into ways to send probes to other planetary systems. Pete Warden is well suited to oversee the Breakthrough Initiatives in his role as chairman of the Breakthrough Prize Foundation. Years ago, he helped develop next-generation launch concepts as a brigadier general at the U.S. Air Force Space Command. After retiring from the Air Force, he put in some time as an astronomy professor, and then he became director of NASA's Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley, where he worked behind the scenes to support space commercialization. In 2015, Pete left NASA to join the Breakthrough Prize Foundation and advance the vision of the foundation's sponsor, Yuri Milner. When Pete connected over Zoom with me and my co-host, science fiction author Dominika Fetteplace, we started out by asking him to bring us up to date on the Breakthrough Initiatives. So buckle up and give a listen.
Well, the Breakthrough Initiatives were started in 2015. They were announced at the Royal Society in London. We were honored to have Professor Stephen Hawking as our principal science advisor. And, he had been a real inspiration for us. Eventually, we ended up with three major initiatives investigating life in the universe. The first one is there intelligent life elsewhere? And this is called Breakthrough Listen. And this is where our sponsor committed our $100 million. In fact, he's actually committed additional money on that. and that program is continuing, probably continuing for another 5 or 6 years. That used to be called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, but we have more accurately relabeled it as the techno-signatures, the search for a technological civilization. That program now encompasses at least 10 separate research programs, involving most, virtually every major radio observatory and many optical observatories and other observatories around the world. What we're looking for is some evidence of a technological civilization. And there are basically three ways to find a technological civilization. The first one is if they're trying to signal us. And that's probably the easiest because they want to be heard. The second one is what we call might call leakage, means that an inadvertent signal is, say, from a something that we're doing, like an air traffic radar or something that we're doing that might be visible from very, very large distances. The third one is you're looking for an artifact. And this is where the civilization may no longer be there, but there was some mega engineering project that might be visible at very great distances. So this is the basic program. Most of the work to date has been done on looking for signals that are deliberate. And we've begun to do a lot more on what we might call inadvertent signals. Now, the problem with an inadvertent signal is it's not likely to be very strong. And we're just now getting the levels of performance from new instruments. In fact, one of the reasons I've been in Australia and New Zealand the last week is in Australia, they're building something called the Square Kilometer Array. The other half of that Square Kilometer Array is the high-frequency one is in South Africa. So these are systems that are now much more capable. They're array systems, and they're able to find potentially a signal from the nearest stars that is indicative of a technological civilization. Now, the first one we thought was potential was about 4 years ago, and it was from the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia. And the interesting thing, it was from Proxima Centauri, the nearest star. We now believe there's a couple potentially habitable planets in the Proxima system. There may be ones in the other stars, of the three stars of that system as well. We're now convinced that signal is interference, and it's very hard to observe things from the surface of the Earth. So we've started a new program. Can we put a radio telescope on the far side of the moon? And that's a major effort in this area. Now, the second major thing is there any life in nearby star systems or in our own solar system other than on Earth? And we have a second program we started called Breakthrough Watch, which is primarily focused on looking at the very nearest star systems for see if we can find a habitable zone planet and that might have evidence of life. And we did make a major potential discovery here a couple of years ago. We used the European Southern Observatory's very large array that is a series of 4 8-meter telescopes. That there's a special instrument called a coronagraph, which can block the starlight out to see a planet which might be, you know, a million or even a billion times fainter than the star. We tentatively discovered a giant planet orbiting in the habitable zone of Alpha Centauri A. That's the biggest star in the Alpha Centauri system. And it's what's interesting, that's kind of exciting for those that are science fiction fans. You know, the Avatar it features a giant planet orbiting in the habitable zone of Alpha Centauri A that has moons that are not only habitable but inhabited. So we might have discovered the planet that I guess they call it Polyphemus in the movie. We have an additional program that we'll launch this next year that's a satellite that can potentially confirm what's in that, the Alpha Centauri A and B, the two big stars in the system, what's there. And I suspect we're going to find a lot of interesting things. The other part of the program is there life in our own solar system? And we considered a number of missions. We funded an effort by Professor Sarah Seeger at MIT that believes that there's some evidence that there's life in the upper atmosphere of Venus, or at least potential for that. So there are a number of space missions, one of which is now being funded mostly by private funding from Rocket Lab in New Zealand. In fact, I'm here in New Zealand to discuss this mission with them. And the instrument itself is being funded by Schmidt Sciences, a fellow philanthropic organization doing science. So I think the second one is quite exciting, that says that we may find soon that there is evidence of life elsewhere, and maybe even the nearest star systems. The third program was Breakthrough Starshot, which we started in 2016, that says, can we send probes to the nearest star systems? We've made significant progress on that, although it looks like that the way we would do that is we would use a very powerful laser to push a light sail, which is maybe a 5-10 meter light sail that weighs a few grams. This looks to be quite feasible. However, it seems to be something that is still pretty expensive. It probably wouldn't be feasible until later in the century. So we've put that on hold for a period of time to try to look at, are there near-term applications of this technology, which there may be. Light sails, they have a significant potential for the ability to explore our own solar system. And so all three of these programs are quite exciting. We also have an annual conference, which we bring people together to discuss life in the universe. That's called the Breakthrough Discuss Conference. And we've moved our primary efforts for the first program to Oxford University. So this middle of July, we're having a major conference at Oxford.
Wow, that's quite an agenda you got there. I'll get back to Starshot in a little bit, but I want to hear about the Toleman telescope mission, which I think you referred to. I'm interested in finding out how far along you are with that, just in terms of what a launch date might be or what the launch vehicle might be. And also on Venus, it's interesting that NASA is considering their own missions to Venus. Does that mesh with what the Breakthrough Initiatives is planning, or is that a totally parallel effort?
Well, let me talk about the Toleman mission. I mean, Toleman actually was the ancient Arabic name for the Alpha Centauri star system. Now it's technically the name of Alpha Centauri B, the smaller of the two solar-type stars. When we started our Breakthrough Watch program, we set up a committee of distinguished scientists. And one of the astronomers, Peter Tuttle, who's a professor at the University of Sydney, came up with a very clever idea. You know, there's a number of ways to find planets. You know, the best one, of course, is if you can directly image the planet. But of course, that's very hard because the planet's very faint against the bright star background. The second approach is if the planet crosses in front of the star, it creates a shadow. And that's what the Kepler mission that NASA did a few years ago, that I was honored to be the center director of the center that led that effort. The third way is one that was probably the oldest ones, is that as a planet goes around a star, the star is also orbiting the planet. But so if you watch the position of the star, it wobbles slightly in space. That's called astrometric approach. And what Professor Tuttle proposed, he said, you know, we can build a very special optical system that if we have a star like the Alpha Centauri system, where there's two bright stars a few arc seconds apart, we can measure the position of one very precisely to the other, down to maybe a millionth of an arc second. And we could actually detect planets down to potentially Earth size that are orbiting one of those stars. So we did a number of studies and said, this could be a small satellite. It could be something that's a few million dollars to build. And the designs looked very promising, so our sponsor said, let's go for it. Now, we had a challenge. One of the big challenges, once we started it, COVID happened, and so it was hard to work with Australia and other, you know, around the world, but it's now going full speed. The program is looking for a sort of first or second quarter next year in 2025 launch. We're still negotiating on the launch vehicles, but it's most likely be a sort of a piggyback mission, possibly on a SpaceX mission, but there are other possibilities as well. The spacecraft is well under construction. Interestingly enough, the company we chose to build the spacecraft is Endurosat. It's a company in Bulgaria, a very capable company, and that does a lot of small satellites. It's a 16U CubeSat, so it's a big CubeSat. It means it has 16 units on it. The telescope is under construction now in Connecticut, in the U.S., and the mission is on track. One of the neat things about that mission is because it has the potential of finding maybe Earths in the Alpha Centauri system, that we managed to get it designated as a flagged mission for the Explorers Club. The Explorers Club is a is for well over a century. You know, people carried Explorers Club's flags to the top of Mount Everest, and it was on Apollo 11, and so they honored us by saying that the neighboring star system warrants certainly an Explorers Club flag. So it's a flagged mission. So we received that flag now. It's on display at the University of Sydney in Australia. So I'm quite excited about that mission. You know, we're looking forward to it for a couple of reasons. One is it's going to explore the nearest star system, which I find one of the most exciting star systems. And second, it's demonstrating very low cost space science. Now, you mentioned Venus. The Venus mission it came out of some of our discussions with our committee. We had a committee that we put together on finding life in our solar system. There are a number of places we looked at. The Europa, flyby of Europa in the Jupiter system, a flyby or even orbiting Enceladus in the Saturn system. But one of the most interesting ones, and it's highly controversial, is there life in the upper atmosphere of Venus? So we funded a preliminary study, and it looked quite promising. About halfway through the study, we realized that Peter Beck, the CEO and founder of Rocket Lab, really thinks Venus is cool. So we got in touch, and he said, look, this is an ideal demonstration of his rocket capability. So they're building a spacecraft that in-house and going to launch, we hope, early next year. We'll see if they, how it's coming. But this is another one of these kind of potentially low-cost things. And like all of these, is sort of passing the hat. We did the initial study, but our fellow foundation, the Schmidt Sciences, decided it was worthy of funding the instrument. The spacecraft, although it's being built by Rocket Lab, NASA Ames said, okay, this is a really good test to their advanced, thermal protection material. So we hope again next year that'll be launched and again a private mission to Venus to, detect. It probably can't prove there's life there, but it can certainly get indications as to then follow-on missions might be done. This is something that, interestingly, we work very closely with the space agencies. And as I mentioned, NASA is supplying the heat shield material. And I think the excitement about Venus has certainly helped, NASA select Venus missions. And the private missions can do some of the more speculative stuff and can begin to develop some of the technology. So this is the best of a public-private partnership, and we're looking forward to seeing a big success out of that.
So in that case, are the breakthrough initiatives and Schmidt Science in the lead position for this, and NASA is going to kind of provide some funding for perhaps that experiment on the heat shield and other things that they might like to have piggyback on that mission? It's an interesting model for space exploration, and I assume that it's the model that you're using for the Toulomyon satellite as well.
Well, it's an interesting question, and this one was, it started out as a breakthrough initiatives. It is now, we are not directly involved in the effort other than supporting our colleagues at Schmidt Sciences. But we did work closely with them to transition what we've done, and we're still working closely as advisors. Foundations work together. That's an important thing. The NASA mission, we helped negotiate some of those discussions, or the NASA contribution. We're not involved in the course of the major NASA missions, but this does represent an interesting approach. When we started the studies on this, we actually signed a Space Act agreement with NASA to work closely with them, and out of that came the agreements to provide the heat shield material. So this is I think a new paradigm that hopefully a lot more missions will go forward using that paradigm. It's sort of one of these things. There's different phases of the mission, and every few months you get something like, "What do we do now?" This is again sort of, pass the hat kind of mission, and And he'd go talk to people and say, hey, that's cool. I think we can do this. And, you know, I'm reminded of the old story about Stone Soup, where the, you know, the
right.
a bunch of people, you know, are trying to, you know, and everybody contributes a little bit. And then you have something that's really delicious, you know, where the stones really didn't do anything. So we're trying to make stone soup out of these missions. And I think there'll be a lot more. There's other discussions now with various folks about potential missions and so forth. But, you know, increasingly, I think you'll see space science missions have significant private sector sort of impetus and maybe even some of the initial studies.
So for now, the Starshot mission is on hold, but I know that it's an intriguing idea to use light sails to try to get payloads to faraway planetary systems. And in fact, in the Netflix adaptation of The Three-Body Problem, they pick up on the idea from the book of using light sails to get payloads to this faraway star, and including using nuclear explosions to propel the light sails along instead of using laser light. Is the concept of using a light sail, is that the most promising way to get a payload to another planetary system?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And that's what we started with. How do you get 300,000 times further away than the sun, you know, in some sort of reasonable time scale? Of course, you need to go 1,000 times faster than we can do today. And there's a variety of concepts that people have proposed. In our estimation, when we did this study, we felt that laser-driven light sails were the only feasible approach to do that here in the next probably 50 years or so. And I think that's the conclusion we would make, that I mean, there are other ideas, but none of them appear to be, you know, viable yet. Probably the closest one that is interesting is fusion propulsion. You know, if you're going to use a propellant, the best thing to do is keep the fuel on Earth or, you know, nearby the Earth, which is what a laser does. It provides the propulsive force. But if you're going to carry it with you, those are listeners that are, you know, rocket geeks know that a rocket is characterized by a specific impulse, which is kind of the performance of a fuel. And you can kind of think of it, well, how many pounds of fuel give you how many pounds of thrust? And you know, typically with chemical energy, it's 300-400 is the specific impulse number. And if you want to say, I want to go interstellar at some fraction speed of light, I would need a rocket, you know, the size of the galaxy. But if you ask, well, what would you really like? You'd like a specific impulse of a million. You know, and so that's, in fact, some people call it the magic million. Now, by the way, a matter-antimatter detonation could produce, you know, many millions. However, we don't know how to make antimatter. But fusion can produce, 300,000-400,000. So you begin to have the feasibility of getting interstellar stuff with fusion. And there are some very promising fusion propulsion schemes that are being funded by a number of places. So, you know, I'm kind of looking at that as maybe a longer-term effort. The thing about those kind of propulsion schemes, you can stop at the other end. It's interesting to me, you know, when we, you know, I said we discovered or potentially discovered a giant planet orbiting Alpha Centauri A. Our sponsor got a hold of James Cameron. We got very excited about it. And so he actually gave us a talk at our annual conference. And somebody asked him how you expected the starships were getting to Alpha Centauri. And he said, well, it was a combination of using a laser-driven light sail to accelerate it and then using fusion to decelerate it. So I think that ultimately something along that line is probably feasible in a century or so, maybe sooner. In the meantime, the question is, what can we do in the next few decades? The thing that got quite exciting for us is using light sails, using sunlight. Now, that doesn't get you to, you know, some light speeds, but it gets you to maybe 10 to 50 times faster than we can go today. And that gets us into near interstellar space. The key there is rather than use a laser, we could use we get close to the sun. Those are called sun divers. And Breakthrough Initiative sponsored a number of workshops. And I think that that's a very promising area that, you know, we may look at funding some of those because it gets you to the, you know, the near interstellar space here maybe in the next decade or two. We also had a design for a laser-driven system that would, you know, short of something to do interstellar, it's would be hundreds of megawatts, not hundreds of gigawatts, that could do similar things. So I think the concept of using light-driven light sails is one that, in the next decade or two, we're going to see a lot of excitement about. And it does have the potential of getting a, you know, I did have our system design people do a study and said, could I use lasers, presumably fusion at the other end, to actually send human missions in any sort of reasonable amount of time? And the answer is, if you build enough lasers, yes. And so I think James Cameron has ideas. I mean, they're a lot and they're big, and it's not something we would do this century. But to my mind, the, you know, photon-driven light sails may be the way that that our species is going to go to the stars.
So one of the big ideas in the three-body problem is something called the dark forest theory. And that's the idea that planetary civilizations get clobbered by aliens if they call attention to themselves. How much of a consideration is that for you and your colleagues on the Breakthrough team?
Well, this is a very interesting question. And we initially had a program called Breakthrough Message where we were going to, not that we were going to send anything, but we were going to think about it. And we've got a lot of resistance to even thinking about sending messages. Interestingly enough, one of the key, you know, skeptics of this was Professor Stephen Hawking. You know, he thought it was a bad idea for exactly the dark forest reason. Conversely, the chairman of our advisory committee, the Lord Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal of the UK, has the opposite view. He doesn't think that's a big issue. So what we sort of decided, well, let's just put that one on hold. But it clearly is a philosophical question. Now, you know, and everybody has their own opinion on it. My personal opinion is that, you know, until you know there's somebody to hear you, why are you sending messages? You know, just throwing bottles in the ocean. And so it's not that it's dangerous as much as that it's futile, and it's a waste of time and money. So that's why we're focusing on, let's see if we can hear anything. And I think the other aspect is that, you know, okay, we have many billions of people on this planet with technologies, and they do things and they send signals that a suitably advanced civilization could easily detect these signals, just like we're trying to do with leakage. So it's probably too late to kind of hide in the forest and be quiet. You know, we're not a very quiet species. And indeed, it's easy to, you know, some of the systems that we're talking about to detect life and evidence of life in nearby star systems could potentially detect civilizations, things like lights, pollutants in the atmosphere. Interestingly enough, the first pollutant in the atmosphere was produced by civilization was 2,000 years ago. The Romans burned down, you know, many of the forests in Spain to smelt silver. And that noticeably changed the atmosphere with the industrial pollutants from mass burning. So, you know, I think the idea that you can hide is unlikely, but it certainly makes for good science fiction.
Speaking of science fiction, the three-body problem started out as a Chinese story. Primarily, it was a Chinese science fiction writer who wrote the books. And in real life, Chinese scientists do seem to be getting more involved in the SETI quest, perhaps in part because they now have the world's biggest single radio telescope. So how do you think that the community that's looking for technosignatures will develop in the years ahead? You're a former military man, so you understand the national security implications of all this as well as the scientific implications. Will the search for technosignatures draw the world together? Will it spark an international rivalry or maybe none of the above?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, you mentioned the Chinese FAST, the 500-meter radio telescope, the world's largest radio telescope. We began some collaborations with them between Breakthrough Listen and FAST. In fact, those are continuing. The scientists involved have been writing papers together. And I think that's a very good thing. I mean, you know, science is a way to bring people together. To be sure, there are challenges. You know, we've had to cancel a number of conferences, but you know, some of them for, you know, it's difficult to arrange international conferences with visas and so on, given some of the tensions. But COVID didn't help, obviously. And but I think, you know, historically, for the last few centuries, that the scientific community, despite the fact there are political challenges, I mean, this goes back to, you know, even the 18th century, where, you know, French and English scientists worked closely together, despite the fact their governments were at war often. And I think that helped eventually, you know, create an environment where people could work together. You know, clearly, you know, during the Cold War, many of the contacts with the Soviet Union and the U.S. were in scientific. Even today, despite all the tensions, you know, NASA and other and the Russian space agencies and others are managing to work together. So I think the particularly in the SETI question, the things that affect all of humanity and the technosignature issues, that this is a great area to work together. Now, you always have to be careful of the technologies, because a lot of the technologies are at the cutting edge. But I think it's, you know, when one deals with data rather than with the means of getting it, that makes it a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. So the radio search for ET has been going on for more than 60 years. And as you mentioned, the focus is starting to shift from looking exclusively at radio signatures to other sorts of technosignatures. Maybe you could provide a little more detail on the sorts of technosignatures that people are looking for. What are we likely to detect first, and whether there's a particular technosignature that's likely to be the first smoking gun for the detection of intelligent life beyond our own planet?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is we started with what are kind of high frequency radio things, like, you know, roughly 1.5 gigahertz, because, you know, the original analysis in the late 50s said that was a wavelength that would go through interstellar medium easy. It was also one being used, it was technologically capable. It was the so-called water hole, the hyperfine transition of hydrogen molecules. You know, so we've searched for that. But so far, we've only searched with what you might call a soda straw. You know, you look at one star and look at another. Array telescopes, these things like the Square Kilometer Array in South Africa, can search dozens of things simultaneously. So we're starting to, we'd like to look at the million nearest stars in these sort of high frequencies. But of course, you don't know what technologies they're going to use. Interestingly enough, on our planet, we're moving away from radio communications. Or at least, you know, sort of narrow band radio communication, spread spectrum, optical communications are increasingly being used. I understand that the country of Norway is going to be radio quiet here in the next few years. They're going to go completely to cable and optical and so on. So when you don't know what the technology is or what they're doing, or, you know, and particularly if they're not trying to communicate with you, you look everywhere you can. And so we're looking at things that might be transients, you know, in the past, you know, even if they're signaling to you, to be transients. So one of the exciting areas is, can we do all sky stuff? Can we do all sky on the optical? Can we do all sky on the radio? And so that's where I think a lot of the excitement is. I mentioned this study about putting a radio telescope on the far side of the moon. That one, we're working closely with the Australian Science Agency, CSIRO, and we think we can put a radio telescope for a border of 100 million on the far side of the moon that looks for transients across the broad spectrum, mostly at higher frequencies. That's a good place, because right now it's blocked from interference from the Earth. Just virtually everything you see is going to be something interesting. Now, there's a concern that as we get more and more activity around the moon, there'll be interference there, but I think the idea is, and the technology is coming to this, we can look across the entire sky with different frequencies. And it's, you know, I think it's an important new development. You know, in this one, I'm kind of reminded that there's the old story of the policeman seeing a guy on his hands and knees under a streetlight. He asked him what he's doing. And the guy said, well, I lost my keys. the policeman gets down, says, well, I'll help you find him. And they go around for about an hour. And the policeman finally says, is this where you lost your keys? And the guy searching says, I don't know where I lost them, but this is the only place I can see. So that's kind of what we've done to date, is just where we can see. And I think we're now seeing that expanded. So I think we're going to find a lot of interesting stuff. Probably almost all of it will be scientifically interesting because it's some phenomena the universe is showing us. But, you know, maybe we'll get that mysterious techno signature.
Yeah, I wanted to just follow up on that idea of the radio observatory on the far side of the moon. Are the Australians kind of working on the concept for that? Is there any sort of time frame that people are talking about for setting something like that up?
Well, I want to emphasize this is it's kind of a pre-phase A study that we've funded as part of our LISTEN program. But we're involving some of these companies that, you know, the NASA CLPS, the Commercial Lunar Payload Services companies. So we've been discussing things with them. We had a preliminary workshop in Australia last year where there are more planned. We'll probably have the next one at Oxford University where you will bring people together. The key thing is, okay, what would it look like? And how much does it cost? And, you know, once we get something defined, then we'll go find somebody that will be willing to fund it. And but the Australians are very interested in this. They have, you know, Australia is kind of the birthplace of modern radio astronomy. So they've long been world leaders in this, and we've worked closely with them. We probably have more programs in Australia than just about any other place in all of our efforts.
You mentioned Avatar earlier in the show, and I'm wondering if there are any other works of science fiction that you consider to be, you know, particularly good or particularly bad when it comes to depicting how the search for intelligent life works in the real world.
Well, probably the best one, you know, it was my favorite, was 2001, you know, the Space Odyssey. And I had the privilege of several decades ago getting to know Arthur C. Clarke and spending some time with him, you know, and that's sort of the aliens find us. And it, you know, I think it's a credible, technically plausible approach. You know, I have to say one of the criticisms I have of the three-body problem is that, you know, the astronomy of the Alpha Centauri system is incorrectly presented. It's not a chaotic star system. It's very stable. In fact, a chaotic system would soon eject one of the stars from the system if you go through the astrophysics. But, you know, I mean, it does explore a really good concept. One of the science fiction shows that I really liked was The Expanse, the television series, because it basically represents, you know, a few centuries from now, humans have a chaotic expansion into the solar system. And in that one, you know, they find alien technology, which sort of suggests the aliens tried to find us, and aliens did find us. You know, that represents, I think, a plausible future. So, and I like that one. As also mentioned, you know, the Avatar is really good because it's a plausible future where how do you discover another civilization that may be based on fundamentally different principles and technology. Probably my favorite, however, just to kind of close this discussion, is Arrival. And this one is a lot of really interesting concepts for where you look for alien intelligence. Is basically the thought processes of alien intelligences could be really alien. And how they understand physics and what physics they understand depends on the language. And I thought that explored that question really fundamentally. And you know, one of the questions, if we ever do get a signal, how do you recognize it's intelligent, it's an intelligent signal? Because the technologies could be much different. I mean, a good example in our current situation is we have other intelligent species on our planet. You know, whales, dolphins, probably elephants. Those are not technological civilizations, but they certainly are very sophisticated and intelligent. So, you know, there's such a broad area that we just don't know about.
That's true. We'll have to study the intelligence of the so-called aliens on our own planet. But when it comes to finding intelligence beyond our solar system, it's always risky to predict when we'll make that first detection. And I know some researchers who have been burned by such predictions, but I can't resist asking you what your guess might be in terms of when we would make that detection.
Well, maybe I could tell when we started the Breakthrough Listen program at the Royal Society in 2015 in London. Our sponsor asked the 15 or 20 people there, which included Stephen Hawking and Frank Drake and Lord Martin Rees and Andrew Yan and others who sort of thought about this. He said, what do you think our chance of finding something in 10 years is? And we went around the table and it was like 1% or a 10th percent or a few percent. I ended up asking our sponsor at the end of this what he thought, and he said 10 to the minus fifth. And to me, it was interesting that why a private sponsor is important, because if I'd have gone to NASA and said, I want $100 million to go look for aliens, and that the experts, the enthusiasts say it's about a percent, including Stephen Hawking, we wouldn't get any money. but you know, here's a person that himself thought it was, you know, very, very small, but thought the importance was very high. So, you know, I would hazard to guess it, but let me just say, I think within a decade, we'll almost assuredly find life elsewhere. You know, we'll probably find a life-bearing planet nearby. We'll find life either on, you know, Mars or Venus, or maybe the outer solar system moons. But an alien techno civilization, I'd say any given decade, it's probably a few percent. But if you don't look, you don't find it.
How do you feel about that? How do you feel about being involved in a search that is very unlikely to produce the object you're searching for during your lifetime?
Well, you know, I should specify that, you know, I'm also involved in the search for any life, which I think is likely to work. But you know, one of the cool things about science is the journey is the fun part, and you never know what you're going to find. So as a scientist, to me, you're pursuing something that is unlikely, but really fundamental to our future, is the most fun thing I can imagine working on.
Well, I love it. And I will look forward to checking back with you, whether it's next year or the next decade, and finding out what the next chapter is going to be. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks to Pete Warden and the Breakthrough Initiatives for the interview. Check out my blog item at cosmiclog.com to learn more about the Breakthrough Initiatives, about the three-body problem, and about future prospects for interstellar transport, including new developments on the fusion propulsion front and Elon Musk's recent mention of an interstellar starship. While you're online, check out DomenicaFetaPlace.com. Don't worry about the spelling, just follow the link from Cosmic Log. Thanks to James Emley for performing the Fiction Science theme music, composed by yours truly. Please subscribe to our Fiction Science podcast and feel free to give us a stellar rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your favorite podcast channel happens to be. And so until next time, this is Alan Boyle advising you to watch the skies.